to perform odd, out-of-place activities. Recall Moni's hissing inner voice that kept repeating, "Piss here, piss here." Phantasmic visions appeared and disappeared. The capacity to organize information or perform goal-oriented tasks collapsed, and new words, fears, and anxieties emerged, as if from the netherworlds of the mind. In the end, all organized thinking began to crumble, entrapping the schizophrenic in a maze of mental rubble. Bloiler argued that the principal characteristic of the illness was a splitting, or rather, splintering, of the cognitive brain. This phenomenon inspired the word schizophrenia, from split brain. Like many other genetic diseases, schizophrenia also comes in two forms, familial and sporadic. In some families with schizophrenia, the disorder courses through multiple generations. Occasionally, some families with schizophrenia also have family members with bipolar disorder, Moni, Jagu, Rajesh. In sporadic or de novo schizophrenia, in contrast, the illness arises as a bolt from the blue. A young man from a family with no prior history might suddenly experience the cognitive collapse, often with little or no warning. Geneticists tried to make sense of these patterns, but could not draw a model of the disorder. How could the same illness have sporadic and familial forms, and what was the link between bipolar disease and schizophrenia, two seemingly unrelated disorders of the mind? The first clues about the etiology of schizophrenia came from twin studies. In the 1970s, studies demonstrated a striking degree of concordance among twins. Among identical twins, the chance of the second twin having schizophrenia was 30 to 50%, while among fraternal twins, the chance was 10 to 20%. If the definition of schizophrenia was broadened to include milder social and behavioral impairments, the concordance among identical twins rose to 80%. Despite such tantalizing clues pointing to genetic causes, the idea that schizophrenia was a frustrated form of sexual anxiety gripped psychiatrists in the 1970s. Freud had famously attributed paranoid delusions to unconscious homosexual impulses, apparently created by dominant mothers and weak fathers. In 1974, the psychiatrist Silvano Arietti attributed the illness to a domineering, nagging, and hostile mother who gives the child no chance to assert himself, although the evidence from actual studies suggested nothing of the sort. Arietti's idea was so seductive, what headier mix than sexism, sexuality, and mental illness, that it earned him scores of awards and distinctions, including the National Book Award for Science. It took the full force of human genetics to bring sanity to the study of madness. Throughout the 1980s, fleets of twin studies strengthened the case for a genetic cause of schizophrenia. In study upon study, the concordance among identical twins exceeded that of fraternal twins so strikingly that it was impossible to deny a genetic cause. Families with well-established histories of schizophrenia and bipolar disease, such as mine, were documented across multiple generations, again demonstrating a genetic cause. But what actual genes were involved? Since the late 1990s, a host of novel DNA sequencing methods, called massively parallel DNA sequencing or next-generation sequencing, have allowed geneticists to sequence hundreds of millions of base pairs from any human genome. Massively parallel sequencing is an enormous scale-up of the standard sequencing method. The human genome is fragmented into tens of thousands of shards. These DNA fragments are sequenced at the same time, that is, in parallel, and the genome is reassembled using computers to find the overlaps between the sequences. The method can be applied to sequence the entire genome, termed whole genome sequencing, or to chosen parts of the genome, such as the protein-encoding exons, termed exome sequencing. Massively parallel sequencing is especially effective for gene hunting when one closely related genome can be compared to another. If one member of a family has a disease, and all other members do not, then finding the gene becomes immeasurably simplified. Gene hunting devolves into a spot-the-odd-man-out game on a gigantic scale. By comparing the genetic sequences of all the closely related family members, a mutation that appears in the affected individual but not in the unaffected relatives can be found. The sporadic variant of schizophrenia posed a perfect test case for the power of this approach. In 2013, an enormous study identified 623 young men and women with schizophrenia whose parents and siblings were unaffected. Gene sequencing was performed on these families. Since most parts of the genome are shared in any given family, only the culprit genes fell out as different. In 617 such cases, a culprit mutation was found in the child that was not present in either parent. On average, each child had only one mutation, although an occasional child had more. Nearly 80% of the mutations occurred in the chromosome derived from the father, and the father's age was a prominent risk factor, suggesting that the mutations may occur during spermiogenesis, particularly in older males. Many of these mutations, predictably, involve genes that affect the synapses between nerves or the development of the nervous system. Although hundreds of mutations occurred in hundreds of genes across the 617 cases, occasionally the same mutant gene was found in several independent families, thereby vastly strengthening the likelihood of its links to the disorder. By definition, these mutations are sporadic or de novo, that is, they occurred during the conception of the child. Sporadic schizophrenia is the consequence of alterations in neural development caused by the alterations of genes that specify the development of the nervous system. Strikingly, many of the genes found in this study have also been implicated in sporadic autism and bipolar disease. But what about genes for familial schizophrenia? At first, you might imagine that finding genes for the familial variant would be easier. Schizophrenia that runs through families, like a saw blade cutting through generations, is more common to start with, and patients are easier to find and track. But counterintuitively, perhaps, identifying genes in complex familial diseases turns out to be much more difficult. Finding a gene that causes the sporadic or spontaneous variant of a disorder is like searching for a needle in a haystack. You compare two genomes, trying to find small differences, and with enough data and computational power, such differences can generally be identified. But searching for multiple gene variants that cause a familial disease is like looking for a haystack in a haystack. Which parts of the haystack, that is, which combination of gene variants, increase the risk, and what parts are innocent bystanders? Parents and children naturally share parts of their genome, but which of those shared parts are relevant to the inherited disease? The first problem, spot the outlier, requires computational power. The second, deconvolute the similarity, demands conceptual subtlety. Despite these hurdles, geneticists have begun systematic hunts for such genes, using combinations of genetic techniques, including linkage analysis to map the culprit genes to their physical locations on chromosomes, large association studies to identify genes that correlate with the disease, and next-generation sequencing to identify the genes and mutations. Based on the analysis of genomes, we know that there are at least 108 genes, or rather, genetic regions, associated with schizophrenia, although we know the identity of only a handful of these culprits. Notably, no single gene stands out as the sole driver of the risk. The contrast with breast cancer is revealing. There are certainly multiple genes implicated in hereditary breast cancer, but single genes, such as BRCA1, are powerful enough to drive the risk. Even if we cannot predict when a woman with BRCA1 will get breast cancer, she has a 70 to 80% lifetime risk of developing breast cancer. Schizophrenia generally does not seem to have such strong single drivers or predictors of disease. There are lots of small common genetic effects scattered across the genome, one researcher said. There are many different biological processes involved. Familial schizophrenia, like normal human features such as intelligence and temperament, is thus highly heritable, but only moderately inheritable. In other words, genes, hereditary determinants, are crucially important to the future development of the disorder. If you possess a particular combination of genes, the chance of developing the illness is extremely high, hence the striking concordance among identical twins. On the other hand, the inheritance of the disorder across generations is complex. Since genes are mixed and matched in every generation, the chance that you will inherit the exact permutation of variants from your father or mother is dramatically lower. In some families, perhaps, there are fewer gene variants, but with more potent effects, thereby explaining the recurrence of the disorder across generations. In other families, the genes may have weaker effects and require deeper modifiers and triggers, thereby explaining the infrequent inheritance. In yet other families, a single highly penetrant gene is accidentally mutated in sperm or egg cells before conception, leading to the observed cases of sporadic schizophrenia. Can we imagine a genetic test for schizophrenia? The first step would involve creating a compendium of all the genes involved. a gargantuan project for human genomics. But even such a compendium would be insufficient. Genetic studies clearly indicate that some mutations only act in concert with other mutations to cause the disease. We need to identify the combinations of genes that predict the actual risk. The next step is to contend with incomplete penetrance and variable expressivity. It is important to understand what penetrance and expressivity mean in these gene sequencing studies. When you sequence the genome of a child with schizophrenia, or any genetic disease, and compare it to the genome of a normal sibling or parent, you are asking, how are children diagnosed with schizophrenia genetically different from normal children? The question that you are not asking is the following. If the mutated gene is present in a child, what are the chances that he or she will develop schizophrenia or bipolar disease? The difference between the two questions is critical. Human genetics has become progressively adept at creating what one might describe as a backward catalog, a rearview mirror of a genetic disorder. Knowing that a child has a syndrome, what are the genes that are mutated? But to estimate penetrance and expressivity, we also need to create a forward catalog. If a child has a mutant gene, what are the chances that he or she will develop the syndrome? Is every gene fully predictive of risk? Does the same gene variant or gene combination produce highly variable phenotypes in individuals? Schizophrenia in one, bipolar disease in another, and a relatively mild variant of hypomania in a third. Do some combinations of variants require other mutations or triggers to push that risk over an edge? There's a final twist to this puzzle of diagnosis, and to illustrate it, let me turn to a story. One night in 1946, a few months before his death, Rajesh came home from college with a riddle, a mathematical puzzle. The three younger brothers flung themselves at it, passing it back and forth like an arithmetic soccer ball. They were driven by the rivalry of siblings, the fragile pride of adolescence, the resilience of refugees, the terror of failure in an unforgiving city. I imagine the three of them, 21, 16, 13, splayed on three corners of the pinched room, each spinning fantastical solutions, each attacking the problem with his distinctive strategy. My father, grim, purposeful, bullheaded, methodical, but lacking inspiration. Jagu, unconventional, oblique, out of the box, but with no discipline to guide him. Rajesh, thorough, inspired, disciplined, often arrogant. Night fell, and the puzzle was still not solved. At about 11 at night, the brothers drifted off to sleep one by one, but Rajesh stayed up all night. He paced the room, scribbling solutions and alternatives. By dawn, he had finally cracked it. The next morning, he wrote the solution on four sheets of paper and left it by the feet of one of his brothers. This much of the story is imprinted in the myth and lore of my family. What happened next is not well known. Years later, my father told me of the week of terror that followed that episode. Rajesh's first sleepless night turned into a second sleepless night, then a third. The all-nighter had tipped him into a burst of fulminant mania. Or perhaps it was the mania that came first and spurred the all-night marathon of problem-solving and the solution. In either case, he disappeared for the next few days and could not be found. His brother Ratan was dispatched to find him, and Rajesh had to be forced back home. My grandmother, hoping to nip future breakdowns in the bud, banned puzzles and games from the house. She would remain permanently suspicious of games all her life. As children, we lived with a stifling moratorium on games at home. For Rajesh, this was a portent of the future, the first of many such breakdowns to come. Abed, my father had called heredity. Indivisible. There is an old trope in popular culture of the crazy genius, a mind split between madness and brilliance, oscillating between the two states at the throw of a single switch. But Rajesh had no switch. There was no split or oscillation, no pendulum. The magic and the mania were perfectly contiguous, bordering kingdoms with no passports. They were part of the same whole, indivisible. "We of the craft are all crazy," Lord Byron, the High Priest of Crazies, wrote. "Some are affected by gaiety, others by melancholy, but all are more or less touched." Versions of this story have been told over and over, with bipolar disease, with some variants of schizophrenia, and with rare cases of autism. All are more or less touched. It is tempting to romanticize psychotic illness. So let me emphasize that the men and women with these mental disorders experience paralyzing cognitive, social, and psychological disturbances that send gashes of devastation through their lives. But also, indubitably, some patients with these syndromes possess exceptional and unusual abilities. The effervescence of bipolar disease has long been linked to extraordinary creativity. At times, the heightened creative impulses manifest during the throes of mania. In Touch with Fire, an authoritative study of the link between madness and creativity, the psychologist writer Kay Redfield Jamison compiled a list of those more or less touched that reads like the who's who of cultural and artistic achievers. Byron, of course, Van Gogh, Virginia Woolf, Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton, Robert Lowell, Jack Kerouac, and on and on. That list can be extended to include scientists, Isaac Newton, John Nash, musicians, Mozart, Beethoven, and an entertainer who built an entire genre out of mania before succumbing to depression and suicide, Robin Williams. Hans Asperger, the psychologist who first described children with autism, called them little professors for good reason. Withdrawn, socially awkward, or even language-impaired children, barely functional in one normal world, might produce the most ethereal version of Satie's Gymnopédie on the piano or calculate the factorial of 18 in 7 seconds. The point is this. If you cannot separate the phenotype of mental illness from creative impulses, then you cannot separate the genotype of mental illness and creative impulse. The genes that cause one, bipolar disease, will cause another, creative effervescence. This conundrum brings us to Victor McCusick's understanding of illness, not as absolute disability, but as a relative incongruence between a genotype and an environment. A child with a high-functioning form of autism may be impaired in this world, but might be hyperfunctional in another, one in which, say, the performance of complex arithmetic calculations or the sorting of objects by the subtlest gradations of color is a requirement for survival or success. What about that elusive genetic diagnosis for schizophrenia, then? Can we imagine a future in which we might eliminate schizophrenia from the human gene pool by diagnosing fetuses using genetic tests and terminating such pregnancies? Not without acknowledging the aching uncertainties that remain unsolved. First, even though many variants of schizophrenia have been linked to mutations in single genes, hundreds of genes are involved, some known and some yet unknown. We do not know whether some combinations of genes are more pathogenic than others. Second, even if we could create a comprehensive catalog of all genes involved, the vast universe of unknown factors might still alter the precise nature of the risk. We do not know what the penetrance of any individual gene is or what modifies the risk in a particular genotype. Finally, some of the genes identified in certain variants of schizophrenia or bipolar disease actually augment certain abilities. If the most pathological variants of a mental illness can be sifted out or discriminated from the high-functioning variants by genes or gene combinations alone, then we can hope for such a test. But it is much more likely that such a test will have inherent limits. Most of the genes that cause disease in one circumstance might be the very genes that cause hyperfunctional creativity in another. As Edvard Munch put it, "My troubles are part of me and my art. They are indistinguishable from me, and treatment would destroy my art. I want to keep those sufferings." These very sufferings, we might remind ourselves, were responsible for one of the most iconic images of the 20th century, of a man so immersed in a psychotic era that he could only scream a psychotic response to it. The prospect of a genetic diagnosis for schizophrenia and bipolar disorder thus involves confronting fundamental questions about the nature of uncertainty, risk, and choice. We want to eliminate suffering, but we also want to keep those sufferings. It is easy to understand Susan Sontag's formulation of illness as the night side of life. That conception works for many forms of illness, but not all. The difficulty lies in defining where twilight ends or where daybreak begins. It does not help that the very definition of illness in one circumstance becomes the definition of exceptional ability in another. Night on one side of the globe is often day, resplendent and glorious on a different continent. In the spring of 2013, I flew to San Diego to one of the most provocative meetings that I have ever attended. Entitled "The Future of Genomic Medicine," the meeting was at the Scripps Institute in La Jolla, at a conference center overlooking the ocean. The site was a monument to modernism. Blonde wood, angular concrete, mullions of steel. The light on the water was blindingly glorious. Joggers with post-human bodies ran lankily across the boardwalk. The population geneticist David Goldstein spoke about sequencing undiagnosed conditions of childhood, an effort to extend massively parallel gene sequencing to undiagnosed childhood diseases. The physicist-turned-biologist Stephen Quake discussed the genomics of the unborn, the prospect of diagnosing every mutation in a growing fetus by sampling the scraps of fetal DNA that spill naturally into maternal blood. On the second morning of the conference, a 15-year-old girl, I'll call her Erica, was wheeled on stage by her mother. Erica wore a lacy white dress and had a scarf slung across her shoulders. She had a story to tell of genes, identity, fate, choices, and diagnosis. Erica has a genetic condition that has caused a severe progressive degenerative disease. The symptoms began when she was 1.5 years old, small twitches in her muscles. By 4, the tremors had progressed furiously. She could hardly keep her muscles still. She would wake up 20 or 30 times every night, drenched in sweat and racked by unstoppable tremors. Sleep seemed to worsen the symptoms, so her parents took shifts to stay awake with her, trying to console her into a few minutes of rest every night. Clinicians suspected an unusual genetic syndrome, but all known genetic tests failed to diagnose the illness. Then in June 2011, Erica's father was listening to NPR when he heard about a pair of twins in California, Alexis and Noah Beery, who also had a long history of muscle problems. The twins had undergone gene sequencing and ultimately been diagnosed with a rare new syndrome. Based on that genetic diagnosis, the supplementation of a chemical, 5-hydroxytryptamine, or 5-HT, had dramatically reduced the twins' motor symptoms. Erica hoped for a similar outcome. In 2012, she was the first patient to join a clinical trial that would attempt to diagnose her illness by sequencing her genome. By the summer of 2012, the sequence was back. Erica had not one, but 2 mutations in her genome. One, in a gene called ADCY5, altered nerve cells' capacity to send signals to each other. The other was in a gene, DOC3, that controls nerve signals that enable the coordinated movement of muscles. The combination of the two had precipitated the muscle-wasting and tremor-inducing syndrome. It was a genetic lunar eclipse, 2 rare syndromes superposed on each other, causing the rarest of rare illnesses. After Erica's talk, as the audience spilled into the lobby outside the auditorium, I ran into Erica and her mother. Erica was utterly charming, modest, thoughtful, sober, mordantly funny. She seemed to carry the wisdom of a bone that is broken, repaired itself, and become stronger. She had written a book and was working on another. She maintained a blog, helped raise millions of dollars for research, and was, by far, among the most articulate, introspective teenagers that I have ever encountered. I asked her about her condition, and she spoke frankly of the anguish it had caused in her family. Her biggest fear was that we wouldn't find anything. Not knowing would be the worst thing, her father once said. But has knowing altered everything? Erica's fears have been alleviated, but there is very little that can be done about the mutant genes or their effects on her muscles. In 2012, she tried the medicine Diamox, known to alleviate muscle twitching in general, and had a brief reprieve. There were 18 nights of sleep, a lifetime's worth for a teenager who had hardly experienced a full night's sleep in her life. But the illness has relapsed. The tremors are back. The muscles are still wasting away. She is still in her wheelchair. What if we could devise a prenatal test for this disease? Stephen Quake had just finished his talk on fetal genome sequencing, on the genetics of the unborn. It will soon become feasible to scan every fetal genome for all potential mutations and rank many of them in order of severity and penetrance. We do not know all the details of the nature of Erica's genetic illness. Perhaps, like some genetic forms of cancer, there are other hidden cooperative mutations in her genome, but most geneticists suspect that she has only 2 mutations, both highly penetrant, causing her symptoms. Should we consider allowing parents to fully sequence their children's genomes and potentially terminate pregnancies with such known devastating genetic mutations? We would certainly eliminate Erica's mutation from the human gene pool, but we would eliminate Erica as well. I will not minimize the enormity of Erica's suffering, or that of her family, But there is, indubitably, a deep loss in that. To fail to acknowledge the depth of Erica's anguish is to reveal a flaw in our empathy. But to refuse to acknowledge the price to be paid in this trade-off is to reveal, conversely, a flaw in our humanity. A crowd was milling around Erica and her mother, and I walked down toward the beach, where sandwiches and drinks were being laid out. Erica's talk had sounded a resonantly sobering note through a conference otherwise tinged with optimism. You could sequence genomes hoping to find match-made medicines to alleviate specific mutations, but that would be a rare outcome. Prenatal diagnosis and the termination of pregnancy still remain the simplest choice for such rare, devastating diseases, but also ethically the most difficult to confront. The more technology evolves, the more we enter unknown territory. There's no doubt that we have to face incredibly tough choices, Eric Topol, the conference organizer, told me. In the new genomics, there are very few free lunches. Indeed, lunch had just ended. The bell chimed and the geneticists returned to the auditorium to contemplate the future's future. Erica's mother wheeled her out of the conference center. I waved to her, but she didn't notice me. As I entered the building, I saw her crossing the parking lot in her wheelchair, her scarf billowing in the wind behind her, like an epilogue. I have chosen the three cases described here, Jane Sterling's breast cancer, Rajesh's bipolar disease, and Erica's neuromuscular disease, because they span a broad spectrum of genetic diseases and because they illuminate some of the most searing conundrums of genetic diagnosis. Sterling has an identifiable mutation in a single culprit gene, BRCA1, that leads to a common disease. The mutation has high penetrance. 70% to 80% of carriers will eventually develop breast cancer, but the penetrance is incomplete, not 100%, and the precise form of the disease in the future, its timeline, and the extent of risk are unknown and perhaps unknowable. The prophylactic treatments, mastectomy, hormonal therapy, all entail physical and psychological anguish and carry risks in their own right. Schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, in contrast, are illnesses caused by multiple genes with much lower penetrance. No prophylactic treatments exist and no cures. Both are chronic, relapsing diseases that shatter minds and splinter families. Yet the very genes that cause these illnesses can also, albeit in rare circumstances, potentiate a mystical form of creative urgency that is fundamentally linked to the illness itself. And then there is Erica's neuromuscular disease, a rare genetic illness caused by one or two changes in the genome that is highly penetrant, severely debilitating, and incurable. A medical therapy is not inconceivable, but it is unlikely ever to be found. If gene sequencing of the fetal genome is coupled to the termination of pregnancies, or the selective implantation of embryos screened for these mutations, then such genetic diseases might be identifiable and could potentially be eliminated from the human gene pool. In a small number of cases, gene sequencing might identify a condition that is potentially responsive to medical therapy or to gene therapy in the future. In the fall of 2015, a 15-month-old toddler with weakness, tremors, progressive blindness, and drooling, incorrectly diagnosed as having an autoimmune disease, was referred to a genetics clinic at Columbia University. Gene sequencing revealed a mutation in a gene linked to vitamin metabolism. Supplemented with vitamin B2, for which she was severely deficient, the girl recovered much of her neurological function. Sterling, Rajesh, and Erica are all previvors. Their future fates were latent in their genomes, yet the actual stories and choices of their previvorship could not be more varied. What do we do with this information? My real resume is in my cells, says Jerome, the young protagonist of the sci-fi film Gattaca. But how much of a person's genetic resume can we read and understand? Can we decipher the kind of fate that is encoded within any genome in a usable manner? And under what circumstances can we, or should we, intervene? Let's turn to the first question. How much of the human genome can we read in a usable or predictive sense? Until recently, the capacity to predict fate from the human genome was limited by two fundamental constraints. First, most genes, as Richard Dawkins describes them, are not blueprints, but recipes. They do not specify parts, but processes. They are formulas for forms. If you change a blueprint, the final product is changed in a perfectly predictable manner. Eliminate a widget specified in the plan, and you get a machine with a missing widget. But the alteration of a recipe or formula does not change the product in a predictable manner. If you quadruple the amount of butter in a cake, the eventual effect is more complicated than just a quadruply buttered cake. Try it. The whole thing collapses in an oily mess. By similar logic, you cannot examine most gene variants in isolation and decipher their influence on form and fate. That a mutation in the gene MECP2, whose normal function is to add chemical modifications to DNA, may cause a form of autism is far from self-evident, unless you understand how genes control the neurodevelopmental processes that make a brain. The second constraint, possibly deeper in significance, is the intrinsically unpredictable nature of some genes. Most genes intersect with other triggers, environment, chance, behaviors, or even parental and prenatal exposures, to determine an organism's form and function and its consequent effects on its future. Most of these interactions, we have already discovered, are not systematic. They happen as a result of chance, and there is no method to predict or model them with certainty. These interactions place powerful limits on genetic determinism. The eventual effects of these gene-environment intersections can never be reliably presaged by the genetics alone. Indeed, recent attempts to use illnesses in one twin to predict future illnesses in the other have come up with only modest successes. But even with these uncertainties, several predictive determinants in the human genome will soon become knowable. As we investigate genes and genomes more deftly, more comprehensively, and with more computational power, we should be able to read the genome more thoroughly, at least in a probabilistic sense. Currently, only high-penetrant single-gene mutations, Tay-Sachs disease, cystic fibrosis, sickle cell anemia, or alterations in entire chromosomes, Down syndrome, are used in genetic diagnosis in clinical settings. But there is no reason that the constraints on genetic diagnosis should be limited to diseases caused by mutations in single genes or chromosomes. Nor, for that matter, is there any reason that diagnosis be restricted to disease. A powerful enough computer should be able to hack the understanding of a recipe. If you input an alteration, one should be able to compute its effect on the product. By the end of this decade, permutations and combinations of genetic variants will be used to predict variations in human phenotype, illness, and destiny. Some diseases might never be amenable to such a genetic test, but perhaps the severest variants of schizophrenia, or heart disease, or the most penetrant forms of familial cancer, say, will be predictable by the combined effect of a handful of mutations. And once an understanding of process has been built into predictive algorithms, the interactions between various gene variants could be used to compute ultimate effects on a whole host of physical and mental characteristics beyond disease alone. Computational algorithms could determine the probability of the development of heart disease, or asthma, or sexual orientation, and assign a level of relative risk for various fates to each genome. The genome will thus be read not in absolutes, but in likelihoods, like a report card that does not contain grades, but probabilities, or a resume that does not list past experiences, but future propensities. It will become a manual of previvorship. In April 1990, as if to raise the stakes of human genetic diagnosis further, an article in Nature magazine announced the birth of a new technology that permitted genetic diagnosis to be performed on an embryo before implantation into a woman's body. The technique relies on a peculiar idiosyncrasy of human embryology. When an embryo is produced by in vitro fertilization, IVF, it is typically grown for several days in an incubator before being implanted into a woman's womb. Bathed in a nutrient-rich broth in a moist incubator, the single-cell embryo divides to form a glistening ball of cells. At the end of 3 days, there are 8 and then 16 cells. Astonishingly, if you remove a few cells from that embryo, the remaining cells divide and fill in the gap of missing cells, and the embryo continues to grow normally as if nothing had happened. For a moment in our history, we are actually quite like salamanders, or rather, like salamanders' tails, capable of complete regeneration even after being cut by a fourth. A human embryo can thus be biopsied at this early stage, the few cells extracted used for genetic tests. Once the tests have been completed, cherry-picked embryos possessing the correct genes can be implanted. With some modifications, even oocytes, a woman's eggs, can be genetically tested before fertilization. The technique is called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD. From a moral standpoint, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis achieves a seeming impossible sleight of hand. If you selectively implant the correct embryos and cryopreserve the others without killing them, you can select fetuses without aborting them. It is positive and negative eugenics in one go, without the concomitant death of a fetus. Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis was first used to select embryos by two English couples in the winter of 1989, one with a family history of a severe X-linked mental retardation and another with a history of an X-linked immunological syndrome, both incurable genetic diseases only manifest in male children. The embryos were selected to be female. Female twins were born to both couples. As predicted, both sets of twins were disease-free. The ethical vertigo induced by these two first cases was so acute that several countries moved immediately to place constraints on the technology. Perhaps, understandably, among the first countries to put the most stringent limits on PGD were Germany and Austria, nations scarred by their legacies of racism, mass murder, and eugenics. In India, parts of which are home to some of the most blatantly sexist subcultures in the world, attempts to use PGD to diagnose the gender of a child were reported as early as 1995. Any form of sexual selection for male children was, and still is, prohibited by the Indian government, and PGD for gender selection was soon banned. Yet the government ban seems to have hardly staved the problem. Listeners from India and China might note, with some shame and sobriety, that the largest negative eugenics project in human history was not the systemic extermination of Jews in Nazi Germany or Austria in the 1930s. That ghastly distinction falls on India and China, where more than 10 million female children are missing from adulthood because of infanticide, abortion, and neglect of female children. Depraved dictators and predatory states are not an absolute requirement for eugenics. In the case of India, perfectly free citizens left to their own devices are capable of enacting grotesque eugenic programs against females, in this case, without any state mandate. Currently, PGD can be used to select against embryos carrying monogenic diseases such as cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease, and Tay-Sachs disease, among many others. But in principle, nothing limits genetic diagnosis to monogenic diseases. It should not take a film such as Gattaca to remind us how deeply destabilizing that idea might be. We have no models or metaphors to apprehend a world in which a child's future is parsed into probabilities, or a fetus is diagnosed before birth, or becomes a previvor even before conception. The word diagnosis arrives from the Greek to know a part, but knowing a part has moral and philosophical consequences that lie far beyond medicine and science. Throughout our history, technologies of knowing a part have enabled us to identify, treat, and heal the sick. In their benevolent form, these technologies have allowed us to preempt illness through diagnostic tests and preventive measures, and to treat diseases appropriately. For example, the use of the BRCA1 gene to preemptively treat breast cancer. But they have also enabled stifling definitions of abnormalcy, partitioned the weak from the strong, or led in their most gruesome incarnations to the sinister excesses of eugenics. The history of human genetics has reminded us again and again that knowing a part often begins with an emphasis on knowing, but often ends with an emphasis on parting. It is not a coincidence that the vast anthropometric projects of Nazi scientists, the obsessive measurement of jaw sizes, head shapes, nose lengths, and heights, were also once legitimized as attempts to know humans apart. As the political theorist Desmond King puts it, one way or another, we are all going to be dragged into the regime of gene management that will, in essence, be eugenic. It will all be in the name of individual health rather than for the overall fitness of the population, and the managers will be you and me, and our doctors and the state. Genetic change will be managed by the invisible hand of individual choice, but the overall result will be the same, a coordinate attempt to improve the genes of the next generation on the way. Until recently, three unspoken principles have guided the arena of genetic diagnosis and intervention. First, Diagnostic tests have largely been restricted to gene variants that are singularly powerful determinants of illness. That is, highly penetrant mutations, where the likelihood of developing the disease is close to 100%. Down syndrome, cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs disease. Second, the diseases caused by these mutations have generally involved extraordinary suffering or fundamental incompatibilities with normal life. Third, justifiable interventions, the decision to abort a child with Down syndrome, say, or intervene surgically on a woman with a BRCA1 mutation, have been defined through social and medical consensus, and all interventions have been governed by complete freedom of choice. The three sides of the triangle can be envisioned as moral lines that most cultures have been unwilling to transgress. The abortion of an embryo carrying a gene with, say, only a 10% chance of developing cancer in the future, violates the injunction against intervening on low penetrance mutations. Similarly, a state-mandated medical procedure on a genetically ill person without the subject's consent, or parental consent in the case of a fetus, crosses the boundaries of freedom and non-coercion. Yet it can hardly escape our attention that these parameters are inherently susceptible to the logic of self-reinforcement. We determine the definition of extraordinary suffering. We demarcate the boundaries of normalcy versus abnormalcy. We make the medical choices to intervene. We determine the nature of justifiable interventions. Humans endowed with certain genomes are responsible for defining the criteria to define, intervene on, or even eliminate other humans endowed with other genomes. Choice, in short, seems like an illusion devised by genes to propagate the selection of similar genes. Even so, this triangle of limits, high penetrance genes, extraordinary suffering, and non-coerced justifiable interventions has proved to be a useful guideline for acceptable forms of genetic interventions. But these boundaries are being breached. Take, for instance, a series of startlingly provocative studies that used a single gene variant to drive social engineering choices. In the late 1990s, a gene called 5-HTTLRP, which encodes a molecule that modulates signaling between certain neurons in the brain, was found to be associated with the response to psychic stress. The gene comes in two forms or alleles, a long variant and a short variant. The short variant, called 5-HTTLRP short, is carried by about 40% of the population and seems to produce significantly lower levels of the protein. The short variant has been repeatedly associated with anxious behavior, depression, trauma, alcoholism, and high-risk behaviors. The link is not strong, but it is broad. The short allele has been associated with increased suicidal risk among German alcoholics, increased depression in American college students, and a higher rate of PTSD among deployed soldiers. In 2010, a team of researchers launched a research study called the Strong African American Families Project, or SAFE, in an impoverished rural belt in Georgia. It is a startlingly bleak place, overrun by delinquency, alcoholism, violence, mental illness, and drug use. Abandoned clapboard houses with broken windows dot the landscape. Crime abounds. Vacant parking lots are strewn with hypodermic needles. Half the adults lack a high school education, and nearly half the families have single mothers. 600 African-American families with early adolescent children were recruited for the study. The families were randomly assigned to two groups. In one group, the children and their parents received 7 weeks of intensive education, counseling, emotional support, and structured social interventions focused on preventing alcoholism, binge behaviors, violence, impulsiveness, and drug use. In the control group, the families received minimal interventions. Children in the intervention group and in the control group had the 5-HTTLRP gene sequenced. The first result of this randomized trial was predictable from prior studies. In the control group, children with the short variant, that is the high-risk form of the gene, were twice as likely to veer toward high-risk behaviors, including binge drinking, drug use, and sexual promiscuity as adolescents, confirming earlier studies that had suggested an increased risk within this genetic subgroup. The second result was more provocative. These very children were also the most likely to respond to the social interventions. In the intervention group, children with the high-risk allele were most strongly and rapidly normalized. That is, the most drastically affected subjects were also the best responders. In a parallel study, orphaned infants with the short variant of 5-HTT-LRP appeared more impulsive and socially disturbed than their long variant counterparts at baseline, but were also the most likely to benefit from placement in a more nurturing foster care environment. In both cases, it seems, the short variant encodes a hyperactive stress sensor for psychic susceptibility, but also a sensor most likely to respond to an intervention that targets the susceptibility. The most brittle or fragile forms of psyche are the most likely to be distorted by trauma-inducing environments, but are also the most likely to be restored by targeted interventions. It is as if resilience itself has a genetic core. Some humans are born resilient, but are less responsive to interventions, while others are born sensitive, but more likely to respond to changes in their environments. The idea of a resilience gene has entranced social engineers. Writing in the New York Times in 2014, the behavioral psychologist Jay Belsky argued, "Should we seek to identify the most susceptible children and disproportionately target them when it comes to investing scarce intervention and service dollars?" I believe the answer is yes. "Some children are, in one frequently used metaphor, like delicate orchids," Belsky wrote. "They quickly wither if exposed to stress and deprivation, but blossom if given a lot of care and support. Others are more like dandelions. They prove resilient to the negative effects of adversity, but at the same time do not particularly benefit from positive experiences." By identifying these delicate orchid versus dandelion children by gene profiling, Belsky proposes, societies might achieve vastly more efficient targeting with scarce resources. "One might even imagine a day when we could genotype all the children in an elementary school to ensure that those who could most benefit from help got the best teachers." Genotyping all children in elementary school? Foster care choices driven by genetic profiling? Dandelions and orchids? Evidently, the conversation around genes and predilections has already slipped past the original boundaries, from high-penetrance genes, extraordinary suffering, and justifiable interventions, to genotype-driven social engineering. What if genotyping identifies a child with a future risk for unipolar depression or bipolar disease? What about gene profiling for violence, criminality, or impulsivity? What constitutes extraordinary suffering, and which interventions are justifiable? And what is normal? Are parents allowed to choose normalcy for their children? What if, obeying some sort of Heisenbergian principle of psychology, the very act of intervention reinforces the identity of abnormalcy? This book began as an intimate history, but it is the intimate future that concerns me. A child born to a parent with schizophrenia, we now know, has between a 13% to 30% chance of developing the disease by age 60. If both parents are affected, the risk climbs to about 50%. With one uncle affected, a child runs a risk that is 3- to 5-fold higher than the general population. With two uncles and a cousin affected, Jagu, Rajesh, Moni, that number jumps to about 10-fold the general risk. If my father, my sister, or my paternal cousins were to develop the disease, the symptoms can emerge later in life, the risk would again leap several fold. It is a matter of waiting and watching, of spinning and respinning the teetotum of fate, of assessing and reassessing my genetic risk. In the wake of the monumental studies on the genetics of familial schizophrenia, I have often wondered about sequencing my genome and the genomes of selected members of my family. The technology exists. My own lab, as it turns out, is equipped to extract, sequence, and interpret genomes. I routinely use this technology to sequence the genes of my cancer patients. What is missing still is the identity of most of the gene variants, or combinations of variants, that increase the risk. But there is little doubt that many of these variants will be identified, and the nature of risk conferred by them quantified by the end of the decade. For families such as mine, the prospect of genetic diagnosis will no longer remain an abstraction, but will transform into clinical and personal realities. The triangle of considerations, penetrance, extraordinary suffering, and justifiable choice will be carved into our individual futures. If the history of the last century taught us the dangers of empowering governments to determine genetic fitness, that is, which person fits within the triangle and who lives outside it, then the question that confronts our current era is what happens when this power devolves to the individual. It is a question that requires us to balance the desires of the individual, to carve out a life of happiness and achievement without undue suffering, with the desires of a society that, in the short term, may be interested only in driving down the burden of disease and the expense of disability. And operating silently in the background is a third set of actors, our genes themselves, which reproduce and create new variants oblivious of our desires and compulsions, but either directly or indirectly, acutely or obliquely, influence our desires and compulsions. Speaking at the Sorbonne in 1975, the cultural historian Michel Foucault once proposed that a technology of abnormal individuals appears precisely when a regular network of knowledge and power has been established. Foucault was thinking about a regular network of humans, but it could just as easily be a network of genes. Genetic therapies, post-human. What do I fear? Myself? There's none else by. William Shakespeare, Richard III, Act 5, Scene 3. In the summer of 1991, not long after the Human Genome Project had been launched, a journalist visited James Watson at the Cold Spring Harbor Lab in New York. It was a sultry afternoon, and Watson was in his office, sitting by a window overlooking the gleaming bay. The interviewer asked Watson about the future of the Genome Project. What would happen once all the genes in our genome had been sequenced and scientists could manipulate human genetic information at will? Watson chuckled and raised his eyebrows. He ran a hand down his sparse strands of white hair, and a puckish gleam came into his eye. A lot of people say they're worried about changing our genetic instructions, but those genetic instructions are just a product of evolution designed to adapt us for certain conditions that may not exist today. We all know how imperfect we are. Why not make ourselves a little better suited to survival? That's what we will do, he said. He looked at his interviewer and laughed suddenly, emitting that distinctive high-pitched chortle that had become familiar to the scientific world as a prelude to a storm. That's what we will do. We'll make ourselves a little better. Watson's comment returns us to the second concern raised by the students at the Arice meeting. What if we learn to intentionally alter the human genome? Until the late 1980s, the only mechanism to reshape the human genome to make ourselves a little better in a genetic sense was to identify highly penetrant and seriously deleterious genetic mutations, such as those that cause Tay-Sachs disease or cystic fibrosis, in utero, and terminate the pregnancy. In the 1990s, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis allowed parents to preemptively select and implant embryos without such mutations, substituting the moral dilemma of the termination of a life with the moral dilemma of choice. Still, human geneticists operated within the aforementioned triangle of boundaries, highly penetrant genetic lesions, extraordinary suffering, and justifiable non-coerced interventions. The advent of gene therapy in the late 1990s changed the terms of this discussion. Genes could now be changed intentionally in human bodies. This was the rebirth of positive eugenics. Rather than eliminating humans carrying deleterious genes, scientists could envision correcting defective human genes, thereby making the genome a bit better. Conceptually, gene therapy comes in two distinct flavors. The first involves modifying the genome of a non-reproductive cell, say a blood, brain, or muscle cell. The genetic modification of these cells affects their function, but it does not alter the human genome for more than one generation. If a genetic change is introduced into a muscle or blood cell, the change is not transmitted into a human embryo. The altered gene is lost when the cell dies. Ashi De Silva, Jesse Gelsinger, and Cynthia Cutshall are all examples of humans treated with non-germline gene therapy. In all three cases, blood cells, but not germline cells, that is sperm and egg, were altered by the introduction of foreign genes. The second, more radical form of gene therapy is to modify a human genome so that the change affects reproductive cells. Once a genomic change has been introduced into a sperm or egg, that is, into the germline of a human being, the change becomes self-propagating. The change is incorporated permanently into the human genome and transmitted from one generation to the next. The inserted gene becomes inextricably linked to the human genome. Germline therapy in humans was not conceivable in the late 1990s. No reliable technique existed to transmit genetic changes into a human sperm or egg cell, but even non-germline therapy trials had been halted. Jesse Gelsinger's biotech death, as the New York Times Magazine described it, had sent such tremors of anguish through the field that virtually all gene therapy trials in the United States were frozen. Companies went bankrupt. Scientists left the field. The trial scorched the earth of all forms of gene therapies, leaving a permanent scar on the field. But gene therapy has returned, step by cautious step. The seemingly stagnant decade between 1990 and 2000 was a decade of introspection and reconsideration. First, the litany of errors in the Gelsinger trial had to be meticulously dissected. Why had the introduction of a supposedly harmless virus carrying a gene into the liver caused such a devastating fatal reaction? As physicians, scientists, and regulators sifted through the trial, the reasons for the failed experiment became evident. The vectors used to infect Gelsinger cells had never been properly vetted in humans. But, most important, Gelsinger's immune response to the virus should have been anticipated. Gelsinger had likely been naturally exposed to the strain of adenovirus that had been used in the gene therapy experiment. His brisk immune response was not an aberration. It was the perfectly habitual response of a body fighting a pathogen that it had previously encountered, possibly during infection by a cold. In choosing a common human virus as their vehicle for gene delivery, gene therapists had made a crucial error of judgment. They had neglected to consider that genes were being delivered into a human body with a history, with scars, memories, and prior exposures. How could such a beautiful thing go so wrong? Paul Gelsinger had asked. We now know how, because, seeking only beauty, scientists were unprepared for catastrophe. The doctors pushing the frontiers of human medicine had forgotten to account for the common cold. In the two decades that followed Gelsinger's death, the tools used in the original gene therapy trials have largely been replaced by second- and third-generation technologies. New viruses are now used to deliver genes into human cells, and novel methods to monitor gene delivery have been developed. Many of these viruses have been purposefully selected because they are easy to manipulate in the lab and do not elicit the immune response that spiraled so devastatingly out of control in Gelsinger's body. In 2014, a landmark study published in the New England Journal of Medicine announced the successful use of gene therapy to treat hemophilia. Hemophilia, the terrifying bleeding disease caused by a mutation in a blood clotting factor, threads through the history of the gene in a continuous strand. It is the DNA in the story of DNA. It was the illness that had affected the Tsarevich Alexei from his birth in 1904 and thus inserted itself into the epicenter of political life in Russia in the early 20th century. It was one of the first X-linked diseases to be identified in humans, thereby pointing to the physical presence of a gene on a chromosome. It was one of the first diseases to be definitively ascribed to a single gene. It was also one of the first genetic diseases for which an artificially engineered protein was created by Genentech in 1984. The idea of using gene therapy for hemophilia had first been broached in the mid-1980s. Since hemophilia is caused by the lack of a functional clotting protein, it was conceivable to use a virus to deliver the gene into cells so the body could produce the missing protein and thus restore the clotting of blood. In the early 2000s, after a nearly two-decade delay, gene therapists decided to try gene therapy for hemophilia again. Hemophilia comes in two major variants, classified by the particular clotting factor that is missing in blood. The variant of hemophilia chosen for the gene therapy test was hemophilia B, in which the gene for clotting factor 9 is mutated and fails to produce a normal protein. The protocol for this test was simple. 10 men with a severe variant of the disease were injected with a single dose of a virus carrying a gene for factor 9. The presence of the virus-encoded protein was monitored in the blood for several months. Notably, this trial tested not just safety, but efficacy. The 10 virus-injected patients were monitored for bleeding episodes and for their use of additional factor 9 by injection. Although the injection of the virus-borne gene increased the factor 9 concentration to just 5% of the normal value, the effect on bleeding episodes was startling. The patients experienced a 90% reduction in bleeding incidence and an equally dramatic reduction in their use of injected factor IX. The effect persisted over 3 years. The potent therapeutic effect of a mere 5% replacement of a missing protein is a beacon for the aspirations of gene therapists. It reminds us of the power of degeneracy in human biology. If only 5% of a clotting factor is sufficient to restore virtually all clotting function in human blood, then 95% of the protein must be superfluous, a buffer or reservoir possibly maintained in the human body as a backup in the event of a truly catastrophic bleed. If the same principle holds for other genetic diseases caused by single genes, for cystic fibrosis, say, then gene therapy might be vastly more tractable than had previously been imagined. Even the inefficient delivery of a therapeutic gene to a small subset of cells might be sufficient to treat an otherwise fatal disease. But what about that perennial fantasy of human genetics, the alteration of genes and reproductive cells to create permanently amended human genomes, germline gene therapy? What about the creation of the post-humans or transhumans, that is, human embryos with permanently modified genomes? By the early 1990s, the challenge of permanent human genome engineering had been reduced to 3 scientific hurdles. Each of these had once seemed like an impossible scientific challenge, but each is on the verge of being solved. The most remarkable fact about human genomic engineering today is not how far out of reach it is, but how perilously, tantalizingly near. The first challenge was the establishment of a reliable human embryonic stem cell. ES cells are stem cells derived from the inner pith of early embryos. They live in transit between cells and organisms. They can be grown and manipulated like a cell line in the lab, but are also capable of forming all the tissue layers of a living embryo. The alteration of the genome of an ES cell is thus a convenient stepping stone to the permanent alteration of an organism's genome. If the genome of an ES cell can be changed intentionally, then that genetic change could potentially be introduced into an embryo, into all organs formed within the embryo, and thus into an organism. The genetic modification of ES cells is the rather narrow pass through which every fantasy of germline genomic engineering has to travel. In the late 1990s, James Thompson, an embryologist in Wisconsin, began to experiment with human embryos to derive stem cells from them. Although mouse ES cells had been known since the late 1970s, dozens of attempts to find human analogs had failed. Thompson traced these failures to 2 factors, bad seed and bad soil. The starting material for the establishment of human stem cells was often of poor quality, and the conditions for their growth were suboptimal. As a graduate student in the 1980s, Thompson had studied mouse ES cells intensively. Like a hothouse gardener capable of coaxing exotic plants to live and propagate outside their natural environments, Thompson had gradually learned the many eccentricities of ES cells. They were temperamental, volatile, and fussy. He knew of their propensity to fold up and die at the slightest provocation. He learned about their requirement for nurse cells to coddle them, their peculiar insistence on clumping together, and the translucent, refractive, hypnotic glow of the cells that transfixed him each time he saw them under a microscope. In 1991, having moved to the Wisconsin Regional Primate Center, Thompson began to derive ES cells from monkeys. He plucked a 6-day-old embryo from a pregnant rhesus monkey, then let the embryo grow in a petri dish. 6 days later, he peeled away the outer layer of the embryo, as if skinning a cellular fruit, and extracted single cells from the pith of the inner cell mass. As with mouse cells, he learned to culture these cells in nests of nurse cells that could supply crucial growth factors. Without these nurse cells, the ES cells died. In 1996, convinced that he could try his technique on humans, he asked the regulatory boards at the University of Wisconsin to allow him to create human ES cells. But mouse and monkey embryos had been easy to find. Where might a scientist find freshly fertilized human embryos? Thompson stumbled on an obvious resource, IVF clinics. By the late 1990s, in vitro fertilization had become a common treatment for various forms of human infertility. To perform IVF, eggs are harvested from a woman after ovulation.